Good morning, everyone, and I'd like very much to thank the organisers for inviting me to speak. I was given the title, The Role of Screening in STI Prevention, and I think there's a number of different ways I could have taken this topic. So what I thought I'd do is just give you just a bit of an outline of what I do intend to cover. So first of all, I'll start with some definitions about what we mean by screening. Then I'll just look at what criteria we need to take into account when we're considering implementing screening. I'll talk then a bit about what I think are some of the benefits of screening with some examples and how we can improve its effectiveness. And then finally, what I want to talk about is perhaps some of the potential harms of screening and this concept of screening for everything and how we might manage that in the future given the sort of fastly evolving sort of diagnostic technologies. So what do we mean by screening? Well, the UK National Screening Committee define it as a process of identifying apparently healthy people who may be at increased risk of a disease or condition. They can then be offered information, further tests and appropriate treatment to reduce their risk and or any complications arising from the disease or condition. Now, I think this is often considered as part of a very structured resident register-based formal programme, but I think when we're talking about STIs, we think of it much more broadly than that, and we're really thinking about including asymptomatic STI testing, which perhaps might be more opportunistic. And certainly in this talk, I'm going to be using that broader definition to cover opportunistic STI testing of asymptomatics. And I think what I should say is what I'm not going to be covering today is comparing the effectiveness of different types of intervention. So I won't be comparing the effectiveness of screening against behavioural interventions. But I would say that STI screening should really be considered as one component of an integrated STI prevention programme. Okay, now I'm not expecting you to read this, but I just put them all up. This is in 2008, the WHO did a synthesis of emerging screening criteria that had been proposed over the past 40 years, and this was based on the original Wilson and Unger criteria. And it was developed in response primarily to genomics, but I do think it has lessons for us in STIs as well. But I just want to focus. All of these criteria are important, but there are just a few I'm going to focus on particularly in this talk. One is that the screening programme should respond to a recognised need, that there should be a defined target population, and that there should be a scientific evidence of screening programme effectiveness. And finally, that the overall benefits of screening should outweigh the harms. Now, if we think about what the potential benefits and harms of screening might be, the benefits are clearly to detect and treat individuals for an infection, also to reduce population prevalence and incidence, and also to prevent individual and population morbidity, so the consequences of untreated infection. But what are the potential harms? Well, there is a risk of false positive test results, and this is especially the case in low prevalence populations, and this could cause unnecessary distress and unnecessary notification of partners. It may also be the case that you may be diagnosing for an infection that might not have caused any particular harm, so that was an unnecessary diagnosis, and there may be some additional cost. So when we're considering how we might maximise the benefits of screening and minimising the harms, these are some of the criteria we need to consider. So we need to think about which STIs do we want to screen for and considerations around pathogenicity and whether or not effective treatments are available. We need to think about which populations do we screen everyone, just a select target population, and we might need to take into account infection prevalence. How do we want to implement it? Do we want to have a formal register-based system or more fluid opportunistic programme? How do we increase testing coverage to ensure that it's high enough for screening to be effective? And do we need to think about routine retesting or not? And finally, we need to think about evaluation. Are we having any impact? Is it effective what we're doing? And how do we monitor that and how we deliver the programme? So I'd like to start by looking for spolic chlamydia screening. So if we think about chlamydia, as we all know, it's typically got a high prevalence, especially in young adults. And a very recent literature review by the ECDC in Europe suggested that of sexually experienced adults under 25, prevalence could, this is population prevalence, varied between 0.6 and 8% in women and 0.8 and 6% in men. So you can see quite a broad range there, but overall quite a high prevalence. Now, we know it's a known cause of reproductive morbidity, and the most recent evidence synthesis published in the American Journal of Epidemiology suggested that the probability that an episode of chlamydia would cause clinical PID was about 0.16 or 16%, and that was the same using both methods that they used to estimate this. We know, I mean, estimates vary, but it is mostly asymptomatic, particularly in women, and it's easily treatable. So on the face of it, chlamydia is ticking most of the boxes for when you might want to implement a screening program. And in fact, as we all know, there have been a range of testing policies and screening policies implemented globally. And these range from just having clinical guidelines to having more structured programs. But even for chlamydia, screening has not been without controversy, particularly around how it should be implemented to make sure that it remains effective. And this is just one example, this paper by Nicola Lowe, a review where she looks at what the evidence is for opportunistic screening programmes for the effectiveness of it and finds that it's actually rather lacking. So do we have any evidence that chlamydia screening is going to be effective? Well, this is evidence from the most recent evidence on from a literature review in multi-parameter evidence synthesis. And what these have shown is that from the pooled risk ratio from four randomised controlled trials of all-cause PID in women who were invited to have a screen is about 0.64, so in other words about a 36% reduction compared to controls. And the recent evidence synthesis from Price in the American Journal of Epidemiology suggested that annual screening for chlamydia would prevent between 55% and 61% of chlamydia-related PID, so as opposed to all-cause PID. So actually, although it has been controversial, the recent evidence is suggesting that it probably is going to be quite effective in at least reducing PID. And this graph here, which is probably not very clear, but this is just showing trends of PID. These are in England, but you see very similar trends in many, particularly Western industrialised countries, where they've been doing lots of chlamydia screening or testing. And this is showing the trend, in 20 to 24-year-olds and 15 to 19-year-olds of PID during a period of rapidly increasing chlamydia testing uptake. Now, this is by no means proof that the screening programme is being effective, and in fact, PID had probably been falling anyway prior to more widespread screening, but it did fall much more quickly in these younger age groups as testing intensified. So it certainly suggests that there may be some sort of association there. Are there any other benefits from screening? Well, there's some evidence that screening can also perhaps influence risk behaviours. So this study from Schnittman suggesting that adolescents who were screened and tested positive for an STI and then they had post-test counselling, their numbers of sexual partners and the probability of having unprotected sex decreased significantly following the positive diagnosis. However, those who screened negative, they did not detect any impact, no significant difference in those. Okay, so as I mentioned before, there are things that need to be considered when you want to try and improve the effectiveness of screening. Clearly, testing coverage is one of them. It needs to be sufficiently high and within your at-risk populations before you're going to have any population-level benefit. Another important consideration is partner notification, because we know that if we don't treat partners, then they are very likely to reintroduce infection back into that sexual partnership. And in fact, repeat chlamydia infection is a problem and is considered really important that it does need to be controlled, because it will limit the long-term impact of chlamydia screening and of levels of circulating infection. So it's important that we control repeat infection as well. It's also associated, or is believed to be, some evidence suggesting it's associated with increased risk of adverse sequelae. And what's important, I talked about the importance of partner notification to reduce repeat infection, but in fact, even in studies where they get very high rates of partner notification and very good PN, you still see that repeat infection is quite common, people becoming infected from new partnerships. And so this graph is just to illustrate the point about the risk of reinfection. And this is from three different settings. These sort of pinky bars here are the reinfection rates in those who have initially tested positive following a chlamydia screen. And you can see that this ranges between 20 and 30% within a year will be reinfected. And this is in young people aged under 25. So very high rates of it's high in any setting. So these are primary, so general practice, sort of family practitioners, family planning clinics, and also STD clinics. And this has been shown in numerous studies. So clearly, it's going to be important to improve retesting in any screening program for an STI, and particularly for chlamydia. And this is an example from England, that data collected through the National Chlamydia Screening Programme there, which shows that, which up until last year did not have any retesting policy, or not any structured retesting policy. There were only recommendations, so there was no active recall. And you can see that retesting rates varied between about 18 to 26% per 100 person years. So what this is showing here, this graph, is the time to retest here from the baseline test. And in fact, encouragingly, higher rates of retesting, these are women who first were tested positive, but lower rates of retesting in men and in those who test negative. And we estimated from this study that if people were retesting on change of sexual partner, as was recommended, that in fact the actual testing rates we were seeing were 20 to 50% lower than we would expect if that were the case. So suggesting that we weren't retesting people frequently enough. So there are a number of things that can be done to improve testing uptake and to have a more proactive approach to encourage retesting. And what this graph is showing here is the uptake of repeat tests using a number of different approaches to encourage retesting, such as just having a guideline, motivational interviewing, financial incentives, phone, letter or SMS reminders, or mail testing kits. And so this is from a number of international studies that have looked at this. A few things to point out is that you can see that mail testing kits do seem to be quite effective at encouraging retesting rates, but obviously that can be quite expensive. So what's also important to note is that phone, letter and SMS reminders can also, you can see, have repeat testing rates of up to about 30 to 40%. And those are in fact very cheap, so that might be a more cost-effective way of encouraging retesting. So finally, I wanted just to then talk about, should we be screening for all STIs? I've talked quite a lot about chlamydia. So we know that NATs are becoming the global standard for most pathogens, and there's a number of reasons for this. We like the increased sensitivity and specificity, non-invasive samples, quick turnaround times, you can have rapid throughput, and they can be at quite low cost. And there are a number of commercial platforms currently available and also emerging commercial tests in the pipeline, which are testing for an increasing number, or likely to be testing for an increasing number of new pathogens. Now, I'll just own up here now and say I'm an epidemiologist. I have no idea how any of these tests actually work, but I'm just to illustrate the point of what some of these tests are now doing. So we have the new multiplex NATs testing for chlamydia, gonorrhea and MGEN. We have this one from Seegene, which is testing for 25 pathogens, and you can see that's ranging from some classic STIs to bacterial vaginosis to candidiasis, and some of these are common infections that we might expect to be used, and others that we might be wondering why we are testing for them. And then STI microarray as well, again testing for a very large number of samples, including what we might expect, chlamydia, gonorrhea, trichomonas, but perhaps others that we might not expect. So I think these tests are there, or they're coming very soon, and I do think this raises a number of questions for us around which STIs do we want to test for, which STIs should we be testing for, what specimen type would we use for this? Can we use the same specimen type? Is it equally going to be equally effective for all these organisms? Is this going to lead to a lot more tests at lower cost? And, well, probably it is, but will this actually improve public health, and what evidence do we have that it will do? Or is this a case of technology driving clinical practice? So what I wanted to do finally was to give you an example of a very simple test, which is the dual screening test for chlamydia and gonorrhea, because we did some work to look at the use of this test as part of the National Chlamydia Screening Programme in England. And we were interested in doing this because we knew these are quite attractive tests to implement as part of chlamydia screening programmes, because these tests are widely available. Now, so the chlamydia screening programme in England is an opportunistic screening programme. It targets young adults aged 15 to 24, attending a range of healthcare and non-healthcare settings, and it includes a partner notification. So we were interested in finding out, because that programme, it does feed back to us the number of tests that they do and the number of diagnoses they do. They only tell us about the chlamydia testing they do and the chlamydia diagnosis they make, so nothing else. So we were interested in finding out, were they actually using dual testing in the programme, and if they were, what clinical pathways did they have in place to manage that? And the reason we're particularly interested in this is just because if you look at in the UK, the epidemiology of chlamydia and gonorrhea is quite different. So chlamydia is the most commonly diagnosed STI, with about 240,000 diagnoses a year. It's got a very widespread distribution. Gonorrhea, we get about 28,000 cases a year, so it's relatively rare, has a very concentrated distribution. It's concentrated in MSM and in Black Caribbean populations primarily, and very geographically concentrated, and particularly in areas with higher levels of deprivation. And in fact, this is data from the recent National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles, and where they looked at the population prevalence of chlamydia and gonorrhea in Britain in those aged 16 to 44. And while chlamydia prevalence in that age group was 1.5% in women and 1% in men, you can see for gonorrhea it was less than 0.1%, and in some age groups it just wasn't found at all. So it was very rare. And the reason this matters, this is just really to remind you about the relationship between infection prevalence and the positive predictive value. And this is assuming test sensitivity and specificity of around 99.5%. So if you've got a prevalence in a population of 0.1%, your positive predictive value is going to be under 20%. And it's not really till you get up to about 4% that it's going to be approaching the positive predictive value will be approaching 90%. So in our study, what we did was we then asked all the local authorities in England that were implementing screening, we asked them, are you using, we had a survey, and we asked them, are you using dual NATs? And what we found out was, from the survey, that over half of them were, 53%, were using dual chlamydia and gonorrhea platforms. So, and we knew from the number of chlamydia tests that they were telling us about that we could estimate how many gonorrhea tests that would amount to. And we estimated that that was about 450,000 gonorrhea tests. Now, if we assume that the prevalence in those populations that we're screening is 1%, say, which is probably quite a high estimate, then what we would expect to have seen from that exercise is that we would diagnose and confirm about 4,500 extra cases of gonorrhea. However, even at this prevalence, the PPV is only 67%, so that would leave about 2,200 roughly diagnoses that reactive tests that that probably then wouldn't confirm. And then if you look at a lower prevalence, so say we looked at 0.1%, what you find is that you would diagnose an extra 456 that you could confirm, but the PPV is now 17%, and so even though your prevalence is a lot lower, you still have this very high number of unconfirmed gonorrhea reactive tests, so about 2,500. So now, fortunately, we also asked them about the care pathways and what in their testing practice. Over 90% of them said they were using supplementary testing to confirm. Well, that's great. However, what we also found was that nearly two-thirds of them had already undertaken patient management by this point. So they had returned the results, they'd referred the patients, and they'd initiated partner notification before the patient had received the results. So what this, if you then calculate that back, what this potentially means is that about 1,400 patients were managed for an infection that actually subsequently was never confirmed. Okay, and in fact, we think this is probably an underestimate, because only two-thirds of the sites responded to our survey. And so if we added it up and included those and it was a similar proportion, you'd get to about 2,000 patients. So what do we think are the implications of this in terms of just chlamydia and gonorrhea screening? Well, obviously, both sites are now doing it, so it's perhaps... it's difficult to think we can't exactly reverse this situation now. But what we think we're seeing is really that this program, this chlamydia screening program, has actually inadvertently become a gonorrhea screening program as well, without any real evidence base or need of the need or cost effectiveness of it. So there are potentially considerable numbers of patients being managed for an infection they may not have had. Now, some of those unconfirmed results probably would have been true infections, but some of them won't have been. And this may have caused unnecessary stigma, distress, and treatment and impact on relationships. So clearly, it's going to be really important for those sites that are doing it to make sure they have very robust clinical pathways, including consent and confirmation, and that is done that all the management is done preferably after confirmation to ensure good clinical care. And so I think although in this case gonorrhea screening is cheap or is in fact probably free, there are other costs that we need to bear in mind. And I think this is also true, needs to be considered for any type of asymptomatic STI testing that we do. So finally, I'd just like to conclude on possibly what I think the role of STI screening is. I do think STI screening can have a really important role to play in reducing STI transmission by detecting infections and getting them treated, and that this can be done as a component of a more broader prevention program, including behavioural interventions. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't do it. I do think there are occasions when we should do it. However, it can lack a very robust evidence base. And what is clear is that its effectiveness does vary by the population you're screening, the setting, and the strategy you use. And those things really need to be taken into account before you consider implementing screening. I think these new testing technologies clearly offer unique opportunities for detecting a lot of infections we weren't detecting before. But I think, well, again, we need to be a little bit careful because unselected testing may have unintended harmful consequences that we should be considering, and that we should consider these harms as well as the benefits before we implement screening. And probably, I think, just to say that since a lot of this is already happening, we should probably be thinking about a programme science approach to determine the benefits, the harms and the cost effectiveness of this new world where we're going to be screening for everything in asymptomatic patients. And so finally, I'd just like to thank my colleagues who've helped me with discussions and slides and analysis for me. Thank you very much.
Dual screening is less sensitive than single screening test. So on top of that, you also miss out on a few percentages of two chlamydia infections population.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, I agree, and I mean, I think there's a whole lot of nuances about the different scenarios you have, and I agree with that completely. I've just used that example for gonorrhea because I think it's a particularly big problem that we have picked up, and the way it was sort of introduced, with no one actually knowing it was being introduced, and then this is what's happening in practice, and I think that's just what we need to consider, that when these tests are available, they are used, and we need to manage that, and we need to think about that, because you can do harm as well as good.
Thank you, Gwen.
Okay.